listening to Bits on Me, the podcast about women's bodies, all the things we should know about them, and all the stories behind them. This week, I'm talking to Orla Kirby, a 41-year-old fundraising professional, yoga teacher, runner, and lover of sea swimming. As you'll hear occasionally in this episode, she's also a dog fanatic and has a couple of canine friends at home. Orla gave birth to her daughter last October after a long journey with endometriosis, cysts, and IVF. We spoke when she was still heavily pregnant about trying to manage her endometriosis with alternative treatments, being asked repeatedly whether she was ready to try to start a family, the heartbreak of a loss after IVF, and the anger she still carries with her sometimes. Before we get started, a quick thank you to all the Bits of Me patrons who are helping to keep this project going. If you want to do the same, go to patreon.com/bitsofme. Do you want to start by telling me about when you were admitted to hospital in 2006 and 2007, about what happened back then?
Yeah, sure. So I was admitted in August, kind of late August 2006. I was living in Dublin and I was living with, I was in a house share, but I was on my own that weekend and I started getting this really, really bad pain in my right side and wasn't kind of really sure what it was. Had I eaten something? Because I was, the pain was making me throw up and I was like, God, maybe, like, I hadn't been out the night before, so I was like, what is it? And I remember ringing my mum, who's a nurse, and kind of saying to her, listen, this is, you know, really, really bad. It's getting worse, it's getting progressively worse. And mum immediately thought appendix because of where it was.
Yeah.
And after probably about 2 hours of the pain just getting progressively worse, she actually came to Dublin. She drove up, picked me up and brought me to the hospital in Dunleary.
Mm.
And I saw one of the doctors there. They did bloods, examined me. And again, same thing kind of went, yeah, it's most likely appendix. And when they got the bloods back, there was kind of elevated white blood cells. So that suggested infection. And I mean, naturally, they had nothing else to go on. Only what I was presenting with. So that was on a Sunday, and on the Monday morning, I went in for surgery to have my appendix removed, and that was fine. Recovery went grand. Then 6 months kind of pretty much to the day later, I was at work, and I happened to work in Dunleary actually. So the pain started again, and I was like, this is really strange. Like, it's the exact same kind of location.
Yeah.
And again, started throwing up with the pain, and the guys in my office were brilliant. Like, one of the girls just was like, okay, come on, we're bringing you to the hospital, that's it, you know, you're clearly really, really unwell. I was doing the whole no, I'm fine. I was only in the job about kind of
I'm fine, I'm just puking loads.
Yeah, I'm great honestly. I wasn't in the job that long, so I was like, I'll battle through, I'll be fine, I'll take some paracetamol and I'll just go home later and I'll be fine. But Sarah was just like, no, listen, you're coming to the hospital. Drove me down, and I must have looked awful, because literally the second I walked through the door of the hospital, it was a porter going, right, you, wheelchair, come on.
Okay.
And a doctor came along, examined me, and was like, are you sure it's not your appendix? And I was like, pretty sure, because you took it last year, so like, let's hope it's not, or someone's in trouble. So I was given pretty strong, I was probably given morphine. I don't fully remember what I was given, but I was given pretty strong painkillers, and I was admitted. The pain kind of eased. So what I had kind of discovered with it is that the pain will kind of build and build and build, and it'll get to a kind of a peak where it's, you know, kind of absolute agony. You know, you've the cold sweats, your whole body is kind of like in spasm almost.
Yeah.
And then it just kind of eases. And eases pretty quickly once it's ruptured.
Okay.
So by the next morning, I was like, yeah, don't really have any pain. I have a bit of an ache, but nothing, you know, nothing to kind of write home about. I'm fine, I could probably go home now. And they were like, listen, there's clearly something going on here.
Mm.
And referred me for kind of further investigative tests and kind of did a full history. I think by this point, like, I'd had a history of quite heavy periods as a teenager, and into my 20s. you know, and I'd had kind of similar pains previously. So I think in the back of my mind, I knew that there was something else going on there, that it wasn't just like a random coincidence that I had pain in the same place as my appendix.
Yeah.
Had supposedly ruptured the year before. So I was referred for kind of further investigative tests and kind of did full history and all of that. And I think at that point I started to kind of realize that I needed to kind of take a little bit of responsibility myself if I wanted to, I suppose, be able to advocate for myself. So yeah. Started doing kind of more research into potentially what it could be.
And at this point, so when you went in the second time, had they found anything? Had they found, like, there was a cyst that ruptured? Had they said anything about, like, oh, maybe the last time it wasn't your appendix? Or was this all just still unknown?
It was still unknown. I mean, I think it was kind of mentioned as potentially it could be this.
Yeah.
But until they did the investigations and got a conclusive kind of answer, it was difficult for them to kind of, you know, definitely say, well, it was this last October or last August. I think the fact that my bloods had been elevated the previous August, they still weren't willing to rule out the fact that it could have been appendix.
Mm.
So, I mean, obviously the elevated white blood cells in the August of 2006 were a direct result of the cyst rupturing. So there was obviously kind of fluid there. There was, you know, my body saw it as an infection, so it was fighting it as it would. So whether that was appendix or cyst, you know, it was, my body was going to react the same way to fight that infection. So it was kind of from the February on that I really started to go to look at and research potentially what it could be, and looking at what the potential treatments were. And obviously I knew until there was a diagnosis I wouldn't be referred on for treatments. So it was May then of 2007. So February, March, April, May, 3 months later, kind of between back and forth and in and out of hospital and checkups and all the rest, that I ended up again in Dunleary having a laparoscopy to diagnose it. So I was diagnosed with the endometriosis then at that point. So,
and I know you weren't particularly shocked at that stage because you'd already done a bit of research and reading.
Yeah, so I found a really, really good book by Dr. Marilyn Glenville. I think her name is Glanville or Glenville. And it was the one chapter that just I kept coming back to, and I was like, yep, have this, yep, have this, yep, have this. So I think in my own mind, there was an element of, you know, this is what I'm going to be told when the laparoscopy is done. So when I came round from the surgery, the doctor, I remember her coming round saying that, yes, you do have endometriosis. We've drained two cysts. So there was two more cysts. There was one on my right ovary, one on my left. It was always the ones on my right ovary had ruptured, though. It was never the left. The left was always that little bit smaller. So my right side, I always say my right side is my problem side. Yeah. And they had done a D&C as well. So there was kind of three elements to it. But it was, I suppose, there was a reassurance there of, okay, I'm not crazy, I'm not going mad, you know, there is something wrong. So this is kind of day one of moving forward with a plan of sorts. So whether that is, you know, treatment or surgery or, you know, further surgery or whatever. So it definitely wasn't a shock.
No. So tell me then about the treatments that you were offered. I know you were given a few options that you weren't very keen on.
Yeah, so when I went back after the surgery, I think it was maybe 3 to 4 weeks after the surgery, I didn't see the surgeon that had operated on me. It was, I don't know whether it was a junior doctor or an SHO or whatever, but their bedside manner left a lot to be desired. I was very much a pile of notes in front of them. Right. And I remember kind of having all these questions about what if I do this, what if I do that, what if I do nothing? And none of them were really addressed. And it was a case of, this is what you have. These are the treatments that are most common. You need to go and make a decision and come back and let us know. And that was kind of the appointment. Right. It was like, how are you healing? I was like, yeah, surgical site is fine. It was laparoscopy. So it was like three tiny little keyhole surgery points.
Yeah.
So that was all fine. And I remember kind of coming out and just getting really, really upset. And there was a nurse outside and she was like, what's wrong? And I was like, I've been told I need to pick one of these treatments and come back in a couple of weeks' time and tell them which ones I want. And I just felt really deflated because I'd kind of been going in with my own. It was the first time I'd ever really kind of taken ownership of going into a doctor and having all my notes written down and my questions and wanting to kind of spend time looking at, not I suppose not holistically, but looking at all the potential options that I yeah. might have and kind of being very, feeling very dismissed at the end of it. And got really, really upset. And the nurse was like, she could see now I was really upset. Now, I was also really angry as well. I was about the diagnosis. I think part of me was a bit, I'd been diagnosed with depression a couple of years before that as well. So I think just a culmination of everything, it was like, you know.
Were you angry just about the fact that you had to put up with all this stuff? Or were you angry with anyone in particular or anything in particular? Do you know?
I don't think I was. Well, I was angry with the doctor when I came out of there, definitely. Certainly didn't help. Fueled the fire. I think it was probably a combination of everything. I think it was a combination of having had depression and, you know, I took antidepressants for that, but I never went to counselling or anything. So I never really addressed the underlying issues. So they were always still there kind of simmering away in the background. I think just that appointment really just was the kind of the tipping point of bang, just everything. So like the nurse was great and she was very, how about we see, can we get you in with another doctor in a couple of weeks time? Why don't you go ahead and do your research and find out, you know, are those drugs the ones you want to go on?
I just have to ask, I mean, so the doctor gives you just the names of the drugs, or did he tell you what the pros and cons might be for you to try this or that or the other?
No, it was just, here are the drugs that are used, that are the most common. And it was basically up to me to go off and do my own research. There was no conversation around, these are the benefits of this one, these are the drawbacks, these are the benefits of this one. You know, I would recommend this one, this is the one that's most common. There was none of that. It was just a case of, here are the names, off you go. I have a big list of patients to see and we'll see you back here in a couple of weeks' time. So I had kind of done my research before I went in. So I knew when he mentioned the two drugs, I had a fair idea what he was talking about. And the side effects for those were facial hair growth and deepening of voice. And they were the two that stood out because they were irreversible. They were kind of long term.
Okay.
And I would be very sensitive to hormones. So I discovered that when I was on the pill, kind of from my late teens onwards, I used to have massive mood swings. So I think between PMS and hormones from the pill and everything. Mm. So I was really reluctant to go on anything that was going to alter my hormones artificially. I knew it was very possibly going to impact me negatively.
Mm.
So, and I wanted to look at other options. I wanted to look at, was there a natural solution to this? Was there another medication possibly that would work? Was there something less harmful? What if I needed to have surgery? Was that an option? So yeah, it was really kind of demoralizing. It was to be told, here are your options, come back to us in 2 weeks at your decision. Do your own research. So yeah, the nurse was great, got me back in then a couple of weeks later to see who is now my endo expert, Professor Mary Wingfield, who is just, you know, is great. I love her. And she had actually performed the surgery on me.
Okay, yeah.
And when I went to see her, she was very okay. You know, traditionally, a lot of people would choose the medication because it's proven, you know, there's a lot of research behind it. These side effects don't happen to everybody. You know, she was a lot more kind of rational. And she referred me into her endo clinic in Holles Street, but was quite happy for me to look at other options. So to look at a kind of a more holistic approach of diet, exercise, Chinese medicine, all of that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Which was lovely, which was just really, really nice.
So what happened then? What did you do? I mean, I know from knowing you personally that you're mad into exercise anyway, between running a number of marathons and doing yoga, teacher training and all that kind of stuff. Was that as a result of this or did that precede this diagnosis?
It kind of came as a result of it, I suppose. I mean, before 2005, 2006, I was pretty unhealthy. Like, I was out like 3-4 times a week. I wasn't exercising. I was, you know, I used to smoke really heavily, all of that. So there was an element naturally of me going, I need to cop on, you know, if I want to kind of progress in my career, I can't be out boozing like three nights a week and, you know, constantly going out for smoke breaks in the back garden of the office. And then the fact that I had looked at things around diet and exercise positively impacting people with endometriosis. So it was probably a merging of the two. And then, yeah, I just got the bug of really liking running. And I think mentally as well, running definitely is just such a tonic. Yeah, it was kind of, it was around that time that I really started getting serious about my exercise.
And then you ended up giving up dairy and meat as well.
Yeah, so I had always wanted to be a vegetarian, but I didn't like vegetables for a long time, so it was kind of difficult.
Bit of an issue.
Yeah, a bit of a challenge. I remember like being in primary school and my mum making me like this, saying, you know, I was like, that's it, I'm going to be a vegetarian. And she made me like this big salad sandwich with loads of vegetables in it. And I was like, no, I can't do this. No, this is too hard. But I think around to kind of 2009, again, having done the research and the book, that there had been kind of research to show that cutting dairy and red meat particularly out of your diet could again positively impact people with endometriosis, you know, and kind of help balance the hormones as well, kind of high levels of fat and estrogen and stuff like that. So I was like, listen, I've nothing to lose, I may as well try it. So that was 2009, and I've been a vegetarian since. Now I do take little bits of dairy, but very, very little.
Yeah.
And I have to say it was definitely one of the better things I did between that and the exercise. I think just again, a culmination and a kind of emerging of everything. And I suppose all through that time as well, I've been, or I had been going to the endo clinic in Holles Street. So that consisted of like every 6 months going for a scan to see were there cysts there. If there were, how big were they? Were they getting to the point where they would have been when they had ruptured previously, and what kind of cysts they were? And then going to see, obviously, Professor Wingfield or one of her staff every 6 months as well. So it was a lot, but it was always great when you came out of a scan and they were like, yeah, so there's no cysts, or there's a tiny cyst there, but I'm not worried about it. Or
yeah. So let's talk about fertility. I know that you've told me before that you you would have been asked a lot about starting a family whenever you went to see a doctor. You know, are you thinking about having any babies? Because that might potentially be an issue. What was that like?
It was really hard, because part of the reasoning for that question is that a lot of women who have endometriosis, who have severe issues with it, find that when they get pregnant, a lot of the pain, the discomfort, you know, the issues, they go for a while, you know. So and it can sometimes take a while for it to come back. So I think from that point of view, they were like, this is one way of getting rid of it for the guts of a year, but also
just be pregnant and have babies and you'll be fine.
Yeah. And then I think the other side of that as well is that the level of endo that I had as well, they were like, listen, potentially you're going to have problems naturally conceiving because of the adhesions and the scarring and stuff like that. So I mean, when you're 27, 28, going into these appointments and you're like, I can't even look after myself on a weekly basis. Like, why are you asking me this question? You know, I remember another time going in and the doctor was like, and what age are you now? And I was like, 32. And she looked at my chart and she was like, do you want to try that again? And I was like, 33? Like, I'd forgotten, like, literally I had forgotten what age I was. You know, so I was like, really? Like, it wasn't on my radar. Like, you know, I was still getting used to kind of being a responsible adult with a mortgage and stuff like that, kind of in my early 30s. You know, my husband was doing a master's, you know, which then turned into a PhD. So like it wasn't something that we felt was right for us at that time, but it was every appointment I went to, like pretty much every once a year at least. So at least one of the two appointments a year, I would be asked, have you thought about it? What are your thoughts? And I used to just always say, sure, if it happens, it happens. And that was my way of getting out of it. It wasn't stop asking me this question. You know, and I suppose there was probably part of me there as well that was like, well, I'm not really sure that I want to go down this route. So I think I was still kind of coming to that conclusion myself.
And then you did come to the conclusion that it was something you wanted.
Yeah. And that kind of, like, it's funny that as soon as my niece arrived, it was like, oh, okay. You know, and it's funny because I've been surrounded by kids, like I've loads of cousins, you know, come from a huge family on my dad's side. And there's like, there's maybe six or seven on my mum's side. And, you know, seeing friends starting their families, I was always really happy for them. But it just, something happened when I think I saw my brother becoming a dad. It was like, oh, that's what the biological clock is. Okay. I'd never had it before, but like, it was just all of a sudden, boom, like just everywhere. It was really difficult when that happened because I all of a sudden went, crap, I'm late 30s and I knew that it was whatever, you know, if we decided to go down kind of the route of, yeah, let's start a family, it was going to be difficult. There was going to be challenges there, and it was going to be most likely, it would be very rare that we would get pregnant naturally and that there was going to be intervention needed. So... yeah, it was funny, like, you know, kind of the last appointment of, I think, 2018 with Dr. Ringfield. And she was like, so, you know, any thoughts about family? And I was like, yeah, so how do we go about this? And she was like, right, okay. It's just complete, like, you know, U-turn from kind of previous appointments, you know, of, that should be grand. So that was a big thing. And also, I feel incredibly lucky that I was in her clinic in Hollisterick, because straight away she could refer me into her Married Fertility Clinic, which is linked to Hollisterick. But we had no, you know, we didn't have to go through a waiting process of, you know, 6 or 12 month waiting list or anything like that. We were really, really lucky. And we did an appointment before Christmas 2018. And then she was like, okay, basically, you try for 6 months, and if nothing happens, we'll look at IVF. And I think she was so familiar with my case and with my history that she was adamant that we shouldn't do any other testing. You know, she was like, we don't need to test your tubes. We don't need to do this. You know, you have your history of scans. If we were to do this test, you wouldn't be able to do IVF for 3 to 4 months. And that's quite a, again, age coming back up, you know. And she was like, that's quite a long time to wait at your age. Like, men never get this at your age crap, so
yeah,
it's really
exactly.
frustrating. Yeah, it's like, I'm well aware what age I am, thanks very much. But apart from when I forget, obviously. But that was kind of that. It all started very quickly, like it all happened very quickly. That we went from going, yeah, let's start a family, to okay, you're in the fertility clinic now, as opposed to being in Hollisterick.
And then you tried and nothing happened naturally.
Yeah. So, we tried for 6 months and nothing happened. And we had an appointment for June of last summer with Professor Wingfield. And we went to that and she was like, okay, let's just go straight to IVF. So there was a couple of things they needed to do, like bloods and, you know, just different things to make sure that there was no issues. Like I'd had my AMH levels tested and they were down at around 4.
What is that?
It basically tests your what your egg reserve is.
Right, yeah.
Essentially. So that, I think they look for a number at around 10 and I was down around 4 or 4.5. So kind of that, as well as kind of the endo, was the other challenge. And again, she was like, listen, it's not uncommon for somebody your age. I was like, okay, that's fine. Kind of after 35, I think kind of egg levels tend to deplete quite quickly in women. So the rates, and, you know, she was very clear, like she was very, very clear with us from day one that if we were to go down the IVF route, like, you know, our chances were, if we had started when I was 34, they would have been this. And now they were kind of this much lower because I was 38, 39. Yeah. So kind of we knew going into it that there was potentially going to be challenges and that it wasn't going to be successful. But I think the decision and the conversations that we both had, you know, myself and Bill, was that at least if we tried everything, we knew we had tried everything.
Yeah.
That if it didn't work, we could still, there wouldn't be kind of a lifetime of going, maybe if we'd just done that, or yeah, maybe if we'd just tried this. So it was, yeah, like it was still a big decision because I suppose financially, but also then injections and hormones, and that kind of, that was the part that caused me the anxiety, was like, oh, the hormones, I'm going to be, I always go to the worst place. I think it's my default setting is that mentally I go to, I'm going to be bloated and I'm going to be sore and I'm going to be cranky and I'm going to be moody. And I was really lucky. I got none of it.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
I was considering so as well that you'd been so reluctant to kind of tamper with your hormones previously, and then.
Yeah. And I think that the fact that I hadn't, say, been on the pill since kind of my mid-20s or kind of early 30s, there was a really long period of having not had any kind of hormonal intervention for anything. Mm. But I was like, I'm just going to have an immediate reaction to it. Like, it's one of the things that my counsellor has told me, like, I tend to catastrophize things. I always go to the darkest place because...
Yeah.
If you're prepared for that, you can't be disappointed in any way.
Yeah.
Like, that's always been my default setting, and it's served me well in some areas, but in other areas then it kind of tends to take the joy out of a lot of stuff because you're constantly going, oh, this is going to be bad, this is going to be bad. So with the IVF, I was like, it's unlikely to work and I'm going to be an absolute antichrist when I'm on all the meds. So I'm going to be great. Brilliant. Fun to be around. Yeah, it's going to be great. So we started injections on the 15th of August last year, and they were fine, actually. I have to say I was pleasantly surprised as to how easy they were, you know, and I know not everybody finds it that easy. I had quite a low protocol of meds, because I had regular periods, and I could kind of pretty much tell the clinic to the day, you know, it was like 26 day cycle.
Yeah.
I think for the first kind of 10 days, I had like one injection a day, and then it moved to two injections a day. And then I had my trigger shot on like the 26th or 27th of August. We had our egg retrieval done. I think they got like 7 or 8 eggs and then 5 fertilized. And we had a transfer done on the 31st of August. And then we had 3 actually that made it to the freezer. So after we had the transfer done, then I was like, might work, might not work. Trying not to get too kind of attached to everything because I just didn't want to be kind of deflated. You know, I was again expecting the call to say, sorry, you know, didn't work. And then there's a 2-week wait after the transfer. We went in, and got a call that afternoon. I was going to the Leyton races with my family. And got a call like before I left the house saying congratulations. I was like, all right, okay. It was bizarre. It was just bizarre. Like, it was so strange.
Yeah.
So, and they were like, you need to come into us at 6 weeks. You know, we do an initial scan. I was like, all right. And I had to ring them back the next day to ask what date I needed to go in because nothing went in during that phone call. I didn't have a pen with me. I didn't write anything down. And it was just like, I spoke to somebody there yesterday and I had a positive test and I'm meant to come back into you, but I don't know what date that is. They were like, yeah, no, this is fairly common. So, so it was bizarre. It was really strange. Really, really strange. And then, we made it to 10 weeks and 4 days. And unfortunately then got bad news that there was no heartbeat. So that was devastating.
Yeah.
It was just heartbreaking.
And that was at a scan? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
It was at our booking scan in the hospital. And you're kind of going in full of hope and kind of promise and expectations. And, you know, I found it, like, I had really only just started to get attached. I think up until kind of maybe 2 weeks before that, I was slightly in denial. Not denial, but it was still very surreal that it had worked. And we had only told, I think, my family the week before we went in on a Thursday, I think, or Friday for the scan. And kind of the week before, I had told my brother, and I'd bought my niece a T-shirt saying, like, promoted to big cousin and, you know, all of that. So we'd, like, made this big kind of thing about it. And then I remember that night. It was a Friday, actually, yeah, because I remember having to ring people, like ring my brother and tell him, and he was, I think he was more upset than I was. I don't think it had sunk in at that point. And it was just really, like, I was more upset having to make the call to him about the bad news than I was about the bad news itself, if that makes sense. And I think because we were told basically that we had to wait for a week before they could fit me in for surgery. So I think knowing that I had a full week ahead of me of still being pregnant and still being sick mentally was just, it was horrible.
So you continued to suffer from the pregnancy symptoms, like morning sickness
And I even had them for 3 or 4 days after I'd had the surgery as well.
Really?
Yeah, because my body was still just adjusting to the hormone levels kind of coming back to themselves. So that was cruel. Yeah, nature can be very, very cruel sometimes. Like I can't fault the hospital. Like they were amazing. They were so amazing. They minded us so well, you know, and we're so kind. And I remember one of the nurses, when she checked me in the morning I was having the surgery, was putting the very lovely compression stockings on my legs, and she was like, oh, you know, these are designer, like you could sell these on eBay. Like, she was just so like doing everything in her power to try and kind of take my mind off what was about to happen, you know. And I remember being brought down for the surgery, and I got really upset because I had to go down on my own, Bill couldn't come down with me, and I had no tissues. And I remember the porter stopping like in the middle of the corridor. I was like, what is he doing, for God's sake? And he was going to get me tissues, and it was just the kindest thing. Like, it was just the loveliest thing. And I'll just I can't remember what he looks like because I was like just full of like tears and everything. So yeah, it was tough, kind of tried to regroup after that as well. And for Bill, like, it was just and it was kind of coming into kind of Christmas period, and it hit me a lot harder than I thought it would. I think I thought I would be like, okay, you know, 1 in 4 pregnancies ends like this, and you know, it was really early, and it doesn't make a damn difference.
No,
it just doesn't make a damn difference. It's just so cruel. You just get so attached to this little kind of grey fleck on the screen, and you've, without realizing it, like, you've all of these plans made and everything, and it's kind of, you just feel empty. So it took a while to get my head around what we were going to do and how to grieve when we had told nobody. You know, like, I had told people, I had told like 2 people at work. So my one of my colleagues and my manager knew, and they were so good to me. Like, they were so kind, and they really minded me. And, you know, they were both like, take as much time as you need. But it was like, I remember sitting on the bus to work one morning and just starting crying and not being able to stop. And, you know, kind of thinking, like, looking around going, these people are going to think I'm completely crazy, and kind of wanting to stand up and scream like, I'm not crazy. There's a reason for this. But because there had been no visible signs, I suppose, that I was pregnant. It was, you're kind of grieving almost on your own. And that was really hard. Really, really hard. I was so ready for 2019 to be done. I remember everyone used to say that, you know, what are you doing for Christmas? I was like, nothing. I'm hibernating until the 1st of January. I just want this year to be over.
Yeah.
And people couldn't understand why. They were like, okay, grand, you know. But it was just, as far as I was concerned, once 2019 was done, it was behind me and I could kind of start looking forward. And, you know, obviously, who knew 2020 was going to be the shit show that it is?
Exactly. So, I'm sorry to
about
say.
That, everyone.
Yeah.
Apologies.
So at what point do you think you knew that you'd be ready and able to go again?
I don't think there was ever a part of me that really was 100% sure. I knew I wanted to, and again, for that reason that I mentioned earlier of knowing that if it didn't work, that, you know, we could still say we had tried everything.
Yeah.
And I guess I turned 40 last October as well. So I was kind of conscious of the timings of everything. And the clinic had made it quite clear that they wouldn't, once I kind of hit 42, they wouldn't do any treatment.
Mm.
I knew as well myself mentally that the longer I left it, the less likely I was probably going to do. I would have found other things to focus on and concentrate on and to kind of push it and go, oh, well, let's leave it for another month or let's leave it again. And I remember myself and Bill, I didn't want to do it in January because I think it was just too close to Christmas. I think the way my cycles fell, it was very early January and there was just still kind of too much going on. And myself and Bill spoke about it, and we were originally going to go for March of this year. And I just said, like, let's just go in February, like, we've nothing to lose. Like, there's always going to be something that we go, oh, well, this is happening this month. Mm. And then we were going to do that. And like the one thing that was kind of that I was hesitating for in February was the fact that I knew we had a really, really big work event on 2 days after kind of the estimated transfer date.
Mm.
And I was like, God, that's a lot. Because I knew I'd need to take a full day off.
Yeah.
Work. And I was like, oh, there's a lot of work that week. And I just remember kind of something stopped me and I went, oh, cop on, really, like, do you know, there's always going to be something. There's always going to be something that you'll be able to put in your way. So we got in touch with the clinic in January and said, listen, we really want to go again. We're thinking of February. So I had to go and get a couple of scans done to see kind of what way my cycle was and get all my meds and everything like that. So it was a much easier cycle this time because there was no injections. It was all just tablets.
Okay.
So I suppose the biggest challenge was one of the embryos actually thawing properly.
Mm.
And we wouldn't know that until we got to the clinic on the day of the transfer. Okay. So, which again was a bit like, oh, like we could have a transfer that goes fine or we may not.
Mm.
So, but thankfully everything went fine. We did our usual, we went to Bride 41 on the way home. I had my work event 2 days later, just kind of went ahead with it as if normal, and really put it out of my mind, like really just went, okay, just forget about this now.
Mm.
And we went in for our bloods on the 24th and got a call that afternoon. I was on the Lewis crossing O'Connell Street. Got like, yeah, congratulations. And I remember at the time, the one thing that really sticks out from the conversation is the nurse saying, we got a really, really strong positive. Your numbers are really good. So my HCG numbers were really, really high. And I'd never been told that on the previous pregnancy.
Mm.
So I think that in itself, I was like, okay, okay.
So how did you feel then? Were you, did you accept it at that point?
I did and I didn't. So I was very kind of practical about the whole thing. I was like, okay, I know what could go wrong here. And I found that I got really, like right up until quite recently, like I have had quite a lot of anxiety about having a loss. So like every time there was a twinge or, you know, any sort of a pain or an ache or anything like that, I was convinced that it was going to be bad news. Like just completely convinced. So, you know, went in for my early scan. That was fine. Went in for our 12-week scan. And when I say we went in for our scan, it was like I was on my own, like Bill couldn't come with me because of COVID. I think every time I've gone for a scan up until kind of maybe the last one, I was excited. I was like, great, let's see what we're up to today. But the rest of the time, there has been a lot of anxiety around things not working out.
So obviously you found out at the end of February that you were pregnant and then... Yeah. Everything happened in the world.
Yeah.
Just went into lockdown, basically.
So
how did that impact on your pregnancy and the care that you received throughout?
Basically, Bill, my husband hasn't been able to come for any appointments. The antenatal appointments, they can be quite long. There's a lot of sitting around and waiting. And I had always said to him, listen, you're missing nothing. Like, you're missing a lot of women sitting around reading and going to the bathroom a lot. But for the scans, I think the early scan that we had at like 8 weeks, I really, really wanted them there because I was just so anxious that we were going to get bad news again. And that was still quite early on in all of the COVID stuff. And we both went to go into the hospital because we hadn't been told that he couldn't come in. and we were told at the door of the hospital that he was not allowed, that I could, only I could go up on my own. And that, I had a freak attack, because I was like, what am I going to do? How am I going to cope if I get bad, or when I get bad news? I think my mind was still in that place of, this isn't going to be good news and I need him there.
Yeah.
And then I suppose as the pregnancy has proceeded, you know, I get a phone call the day before my appointments to check, have I been in contact with anybody who's had COVID? Do I have any symptoms? Am I healthy? And then at the end of every call, it's like, you know, you need to come in on your own. And at this point, I'm like, yeah, no, that's fine. That's grand. I understand where they're coming from a risk prevention point of view. I totally get it. But I guess having been through what we were through last year, it's heartbreaking to know that there's somebody else in that situation who has to deal with that on their own, and who can't have their partner there to hold them. And to, like, Bill held me up last year. I remember having to walk along the corridor to another room to go through all of our interventions or all the options that we had from a management point of view, you know, whether I want to do surgery or whatever. But physically, like, Bill held me up. And it's just really heartbreaking to know that there's somebody in a situation every day where they don't have that.
Yeah.
And they can't get a hug. And all you want is a hug. So,
but
I have to say, the care, like, my care hasn't been compromised. You know, I've had a lot of scans. They're dealing with the restrictions. You know, it's new to them as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know, I remember one of them saying to me, I got upset about something during an appointment a while back. And it was nothing, like, it was nothing major. I think it was just hormones, to be honest. And she was like, I can give you a scan, but I can't give you a hug. And it was just, it was really human. You're like, yeah, it's actually really hard for you as well, because they're in a caring profession because they care, and they can't, you know, be that support for people. When we do eventually go into labour, you know, Bill won't be allowed to come in with me until I'm in established labour. But I've every confidence, you know, that I'll be well looked after.
Yeah.
So that's the hope anyway.
So you're now almost full term, and everything's gone well.
So far so good, yeah.
Yeah. How do you feel now, kind of looking back on everything? And I mean, I know you talked earlier about the anger that you've carried with you, a little bit about what you've been through and the kind of, you know, the depression that's been alongside your physical health complications. Is there anything you think could have been different, or that you wish would have been different, other than not having to go through this at all, of course?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think it's, the more I get older and the more I research, I'm now that person, like, that the doctor hates seeing coming, because I have a notebook, like, when I go into my antenatal appointments, they're like, oh no, not her again. And I have my notebook of my questions and I take notes, because that's how I advocate for myself, is that I do my research and I want to know these specific questions rather than going down the Google rabbit hole, which is, like, it's a horrible place. But there's more and more information, you know, and there's, you know, the more we hear about how women are treated in our maternity services, and how women are treated when they go to doctors to talk about their reproductive organs or the issues that they're having, and you're still hearing about women being dismissed as, well, that's normal. It's not. Like, I know my body, and if I'm having severe pain and if I'm having really, really heavy periods as a 15-year-old, there's something there. And don't dismiss me just because I'm 15 or 16. You know, believe me, listen to me. And if I want a referral, refer me. Like, it shouldn't be any skin off any doctor's nose to refer a patient. And if there's nothing there, great.
Like, yeah, exactly.
If there's no problems, that's fantastic. There's another way of managing it, but, like, let's try and get to the root of the issue first, as opposed to having to go through years and years of pain and feeling dismissed and feeling kind of brushed off. You know, I wish that the first doctor who had told me about the meds had at least taken the time to go, do you have any questions about those? And I suppose myself then, I wish I'd addressed my depression and my anxiety a lot earlier. I really do. I mean, I've been seeing a counsellor now for probably 3 years at this point, and I see her, and I've continued to see her the whole way through COVID, and we've done kind of Zoom meetings, and she's just given me the skills and the information and the knowledge I need to be be able to advocate for myself a little bit more, and to recognize things that trigger, that are triggers for me. And I wish I'd done that a lot earlier. So yeah, and I suppose just to trust yourself as well. I wish I'd kind of trusted my own self a little bit more.
That was Orla Kirby on Bits of Me. If you think you might have endometriosis or you want advice on symptoms and treatment options, visit the Endometriosis Association of Ireland website at endometriosis.ie or follow them on Instagram at endoireland. I'll also link to another few episodes about endometriosis in the show notes. This week, the special patron thank you goes out to Tony Groves of the Tortoise Shack, who is not only a supporter, but also very helpful and generous with his time and podcast expertise. The Tortoise Shack runs a number of brilliant podcasts about everything from politics and housing to sexual health, so check them out and show them some love. You can support Bits of Me from as little as €2 a month at patreon.com/bitsofme. But any kind of support, like subscribing, rating, reviewing and sharing, is very much appreciated. Thanks for listening.